Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio, Skyline studio here on the 18th floor downtown above beautiful Chicago. And here till 5 a.m. It is Thursday. We're not doing Triple Play Thursday. Mr. Shagru is not in this morning. Dan Long is filling in. And we'll do it again next week. But we will have all of our regular Friday features tomorrow, including Fly Jams Friday. Coming up a little bit later on, we are going to talk about the three deaths that happened yesterday. Mean Gene Okerlund, Bob Einstein, and the captain, Daryl Dragon, the captain of Tennille. We'll talk a little bit about that and play some audio. They were all 76 years old, and it was just very strange and sad. So, but we'll pay tribute to those three guys who passed away yesterday. And we're going to talk about the biggest entertainment stories of 2018 as we look back on the year. And right now, though, we are very happy to have us joined by Dan Feinberg, TV critic from The Hollywood Reporter. And you can follow him on The Fine Print at Twitter and Facebook, The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we're here. He joins us every couple of weeks, every Thursday, every 2 weeks on a Thursday morning. And this is his visit. And it's the first one of 2019. Dan, welcome.
Thank you. Happy New Year, Nick.
Happy New Year to you. How were your holidays?
Reasonably quiet within certain confines, in the sense that there's still just a backload of TV, whether it's Christmas Day or New Year's Day. There's always TV, Nick.
Yeah, that's
how about
true.
You?
That's absolutely. It was relatively quiet. I was off from here for 11 nights, which was in my opinion too long to be gone from my job because I really like my job. So, but it was fine. It was great. Just hung out with family and then. He spent a quiet night at home because I can't stand New Year's Eve, and just watched. I watched Trading Places on New Year's Eve because it takes place at one point on New Year's Eve. Actually, Trading Places is one of those movies. Trading Places is one of those movies you can watch for any of the holidays in any of the seasons because it takes place on Thanksgiving, it takes place on Christmas, it takes place on New Year's, so you can watch it three times during the holidays. So
you don't need to convince me. I am sold, Nick.
All right. Well, welcome back. And you're talking about there's a lot of TV. This is not a TV little topic, really, really quick. I want to jump into because we've got some year end stuff. You've got the worst shows of 2018. I'm really interested in your review of Vanity Fair because I think Olivia Cooke had a hell of a year, like a really great year. And I love her. But it's a Netflix thing. Have you heard about this, what people are doing, the Bird Box Challenge?
I haven't heard what it actually is, but I did watch Bird Box on New Year's Eve just so I could understand what the kids were talking about.
Right.
So at least I'm that far.
It's exploded. I think it's a good film. I think A Quiet Place is better, but I think it's good. There's some pretty cool stuff in it. Did you like it?
I thought it was okay. I mean, to me, it's the kind of thing where it's such a small and restrictive script that in a perfect world, I feel like it should have been made for like $500,000 or $1 million. And if you snuck this movie into the midnight section at Sundance with $1 million budget and no A-list stars, I think it might have been incredible. To me, it's too polished. It's too much a star vehicle for Sandra Bullock, and I think it would have been much better served to be a smaller movie and a more intimate movie, personally.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is the Bird Box Challenge, Dan. Those crazy kids who were eating Tide Pods and, you know, doing planking and doing all this stupid stuff are now challenging themselves to do household activities or walk around blindfolded and film it. And Netflix actually had to make a statement saying, don't do that. this is a story that broke late yesterday. And some people,
yeah.
Those kids are blindfolding themselves and they're walking around doing the Bird Box Challenge. And Netflix actually had to say, don't do that. It's just so mind-boggling to me.
I am definitely impressed by how very clearly this movie did become a phenomenon of some sort. You know, Netflix actually released something resembling vaguely viewership figures for it. And Netflix doesn't do that. And that makes the figures that they released entirely suspect, and I frankly don't believe them or care about them because I have no comparative data to understand what they actually mean.
Right.
But that being said, very clearly, this is a movie that hit a chord that was released at a very specific time where apparently people didn't want to go out to the movies quite so much and were perfectly happy to watch a Sandra Bullock movie at home. And, it was fun watching on Twitter just how very interestingly this blew up because I did not know it was going to. So many of Netflix's original movies pop up and vanish or pop up and become sort of strange little phenomenon. This one, kind of big.
Yeah, real big. And I had watched it before it all blew up and went crazy. Like I watched it immediately because it's a horror movie and I happen to really like Sandra Bullock, and so that's all I needed. So I watched it immediately and then frankly was really, really surprised at how much it blew up, because I don't think it's good enough for the kind of attention and insanity that it's receiving right now. So
I think that Sandra Bullock really is a genuine movie star, and that gives this an advantage, and it didn't feel like kind of a low-budget movie star knockoff like everything that Adam Sandler does for Netflix. I think there definitely is some credit that has to be given to an inclusive and interestingly diverse cast. I think that is entirely a major piece of its success, and it is a juicy concept, and a juicy concept in a year in which Quiet Place, which I think is much, much, much better, where it struck that chord. And kind of end of the year, people like the ability to just press play on their whatevers and have it pop up. And so, heaven knows, basically all the Christmas vacation was people talking about one Netflix thing or another. So,
right.
They just kind of own our lives at this point. Netflix does.
Yeah, that's true. It's very, very true. All right, let's get to some TV stuff. I want to talk about the worst TV shows of 2018. You also picked the best episodes of 2018. I want to get into that, but I really want to know what you thought of Vanity Fair, because I happen to think Olivia Cooke is the bee's knees right now. I just think she's fantastic. I'm including Thoroughbreds on my year-end best list. I think that was such a great film, and she's so good in it. And Ready Player One, I just think she's great. And so, tell me about Vanity Fair.
I think she's extremely talented, and I think anyone who watched Bates Motel for any of its run already knew this.
Yeah.
And she's very, very good in that as well. Vanity Fair was a BBC production that Amazon co-produced or acquired or whatever it is. And basically, if you know the Thackeray novel, it really does have one absolutely tremendous central character. Becky Sharp is really and truly one of the great characters in fiction. And she's the kind of character where people keep discovering, oh my goodness, this is such an old and dusty book, but this female heroine is such a modern character. And I think that that is both utterly correct. I think she is a great and forward looking character, but it also is such a simplistic observation that it leads to a lot of adaptations of Vanity Fair that don't go very deep because they're so entranced by this surface quality. And I think that was part of the problem with the Reese Witherspoon adaptation a couple of years ago. It's just a general problem with adapting it for TV. And I think that this is a very straightforward, not particularly thoughtful adaptation, but Olivia Cooke is charming, and she's particularly good in the first half when the age of the character more closely matches her actual age.
Right.
As the character is supposed to age and mature, I didn't buy it quite as much. I think that Olivia Cooke has some work to do before she's going to be convincing as wholly a 20-something young woman, or even up to 30 towards the end of Vanity Fair. But, she is really front and center for the entire seventh episode miniseries, and she's very good. So if one were to want to be an Olivia Cooke completist, I think this is a very good showcase for her. It's a good opportunity to see her speaking with her native British accent, which is charming, and she gets to sing a little bit, which she also does charmingly. She's extremely talented. I understand completely why she is having this moment and why people want to work with her. She, of course, has those wonderfully expressive eyes, and they can go a long, long way. She's sort of part of a generation of young actresses who are almost verging on anime characters. They're so expressive at times.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a pretty good asset to have. It's just not quite sharp enough. Pun apparently intended, since the main character is Becky Sharp, and I'm pretty sure I made the exact same pun in my review, so I'll just feel ashamed about that one for a while. It's just not thoughtful enough to be a really, really good piece of adaptation. It doesn't have enough to say, but as a very surface plot point for plot point, very episodic adaptation, it's pretty decent. That's about as far as I'll go. It's not great, and I think that we're still waiting for the great, you know, 21st century adaptation of Vanity Fair. But
right.
It's a good book, good character. Olivia Cooke's really good.
Okay. All right. I think that's enough for me.
You know, it's only 7 hours, and really she is front and center for almost all of it. So if that is your reason for watching, you will not feel as if you have been slighted in that respect.
Yeah. I mean, look, I sat through Life Itself. Mainly because of her. So, which was just, did you see Life Itself, Dan?
Oh, no. I have watched enough television that I have a very good sense already of Dan Fogelman's potentials for detours and manipulation. Once people made it clear that that's all this was, and also once several people compared it to Crash, I decided that was probably one that I could skip.
Yeah.
But it does appear to be on Amazon for Prime subscribers. So there was about 5 seconds on maybe New Year's Eve when I was glancing at what was available, where I thought, if I watch Life Itself, as I start the new year, the rest of the new year will be better after that. But then I decided not to do that.
And that statement, by the way, would have been true, Dan. So there you go. All right. Hang on a second, Dan. Okay.
Sure.
All right. Dan Feinberg is with us, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We'll take a break for the news. When we come back, we'll jump into the highs and lows of TV in 2018, summing up last year's movies, or TV. All right. We'll take a break, and we'll be back after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline, Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It's Thursday, and we're going to be talking about entertainment, the biggest entertainment stories of 2018. We're going to pay tribute to Mean Gene Okerlund, Bob Einstein, and the Daryl Dragon coming up a little bit later on. Right now, though, we're talking TV, and it's our biweekly visit with Dan Feinberg, who is the TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we're going to jump right back into the conversation. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. So you and Tim Goodman chose your worst TV shows of 2018.
Sort of, kind of on the worst, because as I noted in the introduction, there's a lot of TV, and it's become a lot harder, even for somebody like myself, who tends towards a masochistic streak, to watch absolutely atrocious things, even after I recognize that they're atrocious, which didn't used to be the case. I used to stick with a lot of very, very bad shows for no particular good reason, simply because, you know, there just wasn't all that much stuff, and so I could keep up with those things. So a lot of the things that we put in our worst of the year are, you know, some of them are huge disappointments, some of them are large annoyances, some of them are reflective of really, really bad network choices. So it's not so much the worst, because as I always say, I'm reasonably confident that the worst show on TV is probably still Criminal Minds, because it always used to be when I watched it semi-regularly. I just don't have the time to check in on it anymore, so it's not fair for me to say it's still the worst show on TV. I have no clue. It could be awesome now for all I know. I just suspect it's not.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we got your choices here. Let's talk about 13 Reasons Why, which you put here.
Oh, boy. The second season of 13 Reasons Why was just atrocious and mostly simply didn't need to be made. It was the first season was a very good season of television, and it was based on a book that was close-ended. Netflix tacked on a, let's see if we can add a minor mystery that will keep people around if we choose to go for a second season, and then they brought it up back for a second season that had nearly no purpose to exist. There's a whole courtroom subplot that runs across the entire season that legitimately is the worst thing on TV this year. Even if I watch Criminal Minds, I'm sure it's better than the courtroom stuff in 13 Reasons Why. It's just so, it is a genuine insult to even a very, very low level of intelligence to watch those courtroom scenes. Basically, they undermined half of the things that were successful and characters who were effective and relationships that were meaningful in the first season for no particular good reason. They became really slick and unappealingly manipulative, involving sexual violence and all sorts of things, bullying that really should not be treated with the slapdash, haphazard after-school special approach that they took to it this season. This was a show that was really, really a good show, a show I really appreciated in its first season, and then grew to hate very quickly in its second season.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. I didn't watch the first season, but I heard really good things about it.
It was very good, and I think it's still totally possible and valid to watch the first season and simply pretend that a second season didn't happen. And if you did that, Catherine Langford's performance in the first season holds up totally. Dylan Minnette's performance in the first season holds up completely. And the second season had no idea what to do with either of them. And it's just such a large disappointment, because all they had to do was simply know to walk away. And instead, they didn't walk away.
Yeah. Now, we talked about this before, that like Netflix likes to do second seasons when they don't need to. And we both suspect that The Haunting of Hill House is going to get a second season.
Which so far it hasn't been, I don't believe, picked up for. But yes, it, I suspect that will happen, but it doesn't need one. And so, walk away. One of the shows that was in my top 10 was The End of the Bleeping World. Love that first season. Zero need for a second season. Terrified of what it's going to do to a show that I loved in its first season.
Yeah.
I wish they would know better, but that's just not what the business model is based on.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So next you have here, we've talked about this one already, the episode of the Romanoffs, Brighton High Circle. And there's a pretty interesting reason why this would make the list.
It's just so sour, and it's so sour coming from Matt Weiner, and in the middle of his own Me Too accusations against him, and charges of harassment and abuses of power, and for the entire theme of the episode to be that basically the mob mentality is worse than the crime, even when the crime actually did exist, just ugly. And as with nearly every installment of the Romanoffs, it's wildly overlong, and it's the kind of thing that no other TV showrunner would have gotten away with doing under any other circumstance. And this is the Romanoffs, even when it's at its most effective, is still a portrait of creative license run amok. You know, even when the show's good, you go, man, someone probably could have edited this or something. But at least Matt Weiner is brilliant. This episode has none of the brilliance. It's simply sour and unpleasant and wastes some very, very good actors, including Diane Lane, Andrew Rannells, and Ron Livingston, who all deserve better. And yeah, just a bad feeling. Bad taste coming away from that one.
All right. Happy Together, which is a show I made. I made it through three quarters of an episode.
And I made it through, I think, four or five. I stuck with it for a while because I like to give the benefit of the doubt to network comedies. And also, I really like Damon Wayans Jr. and Amber Stevens West. And I don't know that Happy Together is really the worst of the new fall shows. I kind of just made it representative for the new fall shows because it's baffling. There was a vague premise relating to how one of the executive producers had One Direction star Harry Styles living in his attic for a couple years, basically. And then nobody wanted to say that it was based on Harry Styles, so it became its own thing, and it became its own thing that was based on really nothing. And by the third or fourth episode, you could see that the writers didn't care about the premise and that the actors didn't really know what they were doing. And it kind of, to me, represents all that is misguided about the broadcast television state of things at this point, is that you can get people this talented and you can lure someone like a Damon Wayans Jr. by saying, if this show airs 100 episodes, the amount of money you'll make off of it towers over anything else. And no one actually stops and goes, is there enough material for two episodes, much less 100?
Happy Together
is the poster boy for a phenomenon in which it really probably isn't the worst available option. It's simply one that just makes no sense to me, and everyone involved should know better, and apparently no one does.
Well, I would have chosen to fill that void if you're talking about like network comedies that you want to represent. The lowest. I can't even remember the name of the show. The David Alan Greer, Vicki Lawrence, Old Folks Home show.
That would be Cool Kids, and it would be also a large waste of talent. That one, though, in this case, I stuck with significantly less. I think I only watched two episodes of that one. I simply moved on, and it's also doing reasonably well, largely because Last Man Standing is doing fairly well for Fox. So, yes, I understand why one would feel bad for everyone associated with that
show. Watched it twice. Even after the first episode, I was so appalled by it. I just sat there like, what are these unbelievably talented people? What the hell are they doing? What is this? And then, of course, we've talked about this before, Dan. The most baffling part of that show is that Charlie Day is the creator of it. I mean, what? You know?
Yep. No, that one would have been a completely viable choice, except that that Tim Goodman kind of liked at least the one episode that he watched. I have no idea if he stuck with it afterwards.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So he was never going to make that one of his picks, whereas one of his picks was L.A. to Vegas, a show that I really liked.
Me too.
So it's one of those things where, you know, we're kind of sharing a platform, and we do not walk entirely in lockstep, and probably it's better that way.
Yeah. It's always fun to have a variation on that kind of stuff and to disagree. I happen to think L.A. to Vegas is very funny. I mean, that show makes me laugh. And
I concur.
Yeah, and I think Dylan McDermott is hilarious on it. And the whole Dermot Mulroney subplot that put together was genius. So has that been renewed? Is it coming back?
Oh, no. That one's dead, sadly. So rest in peace, L.A. to Vegas. It's definitely not a perfect show, but made me laugh more than a lot of shows that live on.
Yeah, some of us appreciated it, I got to say. I thought it was pretty funny. All right, let's get back to the worst here, Dan, and you've talked about this one too frequently, Heathers, which has had an interesting life, this show.
Yep, just keeps getting pulled and shelved and pulled and put back on schedules and released internationally and whatever, and, you know, there are just so many levels on which the Paramount Network Heathers remake was bad. There's the very basic part that it's not good. That's, you know, that's kind of baseline things not being good.
Right.
It was a misguided satire based on a incredibly trenchant, sharp satire. So no one involved in the new version had a very clear idea of the kind of satire they wanted to make, how they wanted to make it for 2018 or anything else. And then very clearly on, they were shocked to discover that it was hard to air or promote their show in a time in which school violence or general gun violence were in the news constantly. And so it had to keep getting pulled from schedules out of quote-unquote sensitivity. But then Paramount Network kept putting it back on the schedule for no particular reason and then pulling it again. And my feeling the entire time on this has been, if it's a good show, if it's a show with things to say, then you stand by it and you go, okay, I understand that this might make people uncomfortable, but that's what the satire is about. We don't think this is exploitative. We think it's perceptive and it has value. But I think Paramount Network knows it has no real perception or value, and that means they just had a show that they made, poured a lot of money into, and without having any confidence that they were making a good show, and that makes it all the more unsightly and unpleasant for me.
Yeah, I understand, and actually, when I saw the commercial for it the first time, I was like, are you kidding me? Because Heathers is a great film, like a really great, a fantastic example of dark satire that really said a lot and was really original and really funny. And just the idea that they were going to put it on TV was just, they were doing a remake of it was just, and Heathers, the movie is in and of a certain period of time. You know what I mean? It took place in the 80s, and that's how it felt, and that's how it still feels. So, I mean, I love that movie, and I hated the idea just in general.
I'm not so opposed to the idea. I think that if you wanted to approach contemporary teenage culture and what it means to live in a teenage culture in which you're constantly being trained on what to do if an active shooter is in your school and what that does to a teenage psyche and what that means differently now from what a different version of school violence and teenage violence meant back 30 years ago, do it. I think there is a satire to be made about today's teens and how violence has impacted them. Unfortunately, no one associated with the remake had
well
either the ideas or the guts to do it well, unfortunately.
The project that you are describing and the satire that you're describing sounds great. I would love that. Let's just don't call it Heathers. Just, you know what I mean? So
there's that also, and yeah, the slickness of glomming onto it, especially when several of the best lines in the pilot were Daniel Waters' lines
exactly.
from the original movie.
Yeah.
It was not necessary.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. He is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and he joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We come back, we'll wrap up the worst and get to some of the best TV of 2018. We shall return. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Thursday morning. Dan Long filling in for Dan Chigrou this morning. No Triple Play Thursday. Dan Long will be in again tomorrow for our Friday morning show, and that's going to be fun. So we're back here with our biweekly visit with Dan Feinberg, who is TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we're going through some of the worst shows of 2018. And Dan, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right. Ozark is included on the show or on this list. And I'm not a fan of the show. You like it much less than I do. But I really don't see all of the awards, the love that this show gets. I don't quite understand that.
And this is one where worst means something different, and definitely this is the one that people on Twitter are most prone to responding to me about.
Yeah.
And it honestly comes down to, it's sort of like measuring amplitude in waves. It's the distance between two points, and in this case it's the distance between the show that I feel like Ozark could be and the show that it actually is. And I think that the gap between those two things is greater than almost any show on television, and that is why Ozark is on my list. I think that there is a good show that occasionally popped up in the first season and very rarely popped up in the second season, and instead all you get is a lot of peak TV, prestige drama, crime drama, cliches. The show's cinematography is wretched. It is just such an ugly, dark, perspectiveless visual style that that show has, and it's just monotonous. And I've harped on my dislike for the show enough at this point, but it continues to make me frustrated because I think that Julia Garner is giving a great supporting performance that the show has no idea what to do with. I think that Laura Linney always has the potential to be great, and she's totally wasted. I think that for some reason, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that he's executive producer and director, Jason Bateman has decided to give the least interesting performance he can, and clearly he's more talented and capable of more than that, but he's determined to be glum and monotonous all the time. None of it feels human. None of it feels real. The show has no flesh and blood sense of human emotion or human interactivity, and thus it frustrates me, and yet I will most certainly be watching season 3 because hope springs eternal, and maybe that show I like will become the show it is, but probably not.
Okay. I just want to mention one of Tim's entries here really quickly. And that's camping, which is a show I have to say I loved. I thought it was great, but I understand why people hate it, and most people do hate it, right, Dan? I'm way in the minority on this one.
I don't want to speak on behalf of most people, and I didn't hate it, but I also couldn't make it through more than half of the season. So, even with my relative tolerance for the sort of embrace of ugliness that the show was all about, I could not finish the season. I don't want to say most people hate it, but very clearly not enough people loved it, and I suspect it will be done after this one season.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was one of those, while I was watching it every Monday morning after it aired on Sunday night on HBO, while I was watching it, I was just thinking to myself, I think I might literally be the only person watching this show. That's how it felt. Especially the only person watching this show who's laughing like really hard. So
sometimes that's a good feeling.
Yeah.
Often not.
Yeah. Often not. But still, I stand by it. I thought it was great. So well, let's get to some of the good stuff. Okay.
Exactly. I'm all for talking about good stuff.
All right. Best episodes of 2018. You and Tim put your you could very much like the last one. But these are specific episodes, correct? That must have been how difficult was this to narrow down, Dan?
Well, the interesting thing is that it became difficult because for whatever reason we've kind of. It's not that there's a critical lockstep, but I think that that critics have started latching on to a specific type of standalone episode. And that means that when it gets to be the end of the year, we can only think of kind of the one standout episode from each show because it was the episode that was designed to be the standout episode.
Right.
And we kind of let great in-context episodes of TV slip through the cracks. And so I sort of mixed up my own personal list and tried to both salute very, very clearly standalone-y, I included Teddy Perkins because Teddy Perkins, the Atlanta episode, was the best episode of television I saw this year.
I agree. So, I agree with you.
Absolutely. But there were about, there were about 10 episodes that pop up on everybody's list, and I tried to steer away from them, not because they aren't great, but because they've been covered enough. So something like the monologue free churro episode of BoJack Horseman, it's a great episode, and I could have written about it happily. I just, everyone's writing about it, so I tried writing on some other stuff.
Okay, well, we're gonna get to that. Hang on, Dan. Okay.
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. We'll get to the good stuff, these are specific episodes of TV that Dan really loved, and we'll talk about that and more. We got the news coming up here, and then right after the news, we'll jump back in with Dan Feinberg here on 720 WGN. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Thursday morning, here till 5 a.m. We're going to pay tribute to the three men that passed away, Mean Gene Okerlund, Bob Einstein, and Daryl Dragon, here in a little bit. And we're also going to talk about some of the big entertainment stories of 2018 and more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Nick D Show. And we are talking with Dan Feinberg, who joins us biweekly. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we're just about to jump into Dan's choices for the best episodes, single episodes of television from 2018. And we welcome Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Nick.
All right, so let's get into it. Let's see, the first one that you chose, and these are obviously in no particular order.
Exactly, not ranked.
Yeah. Chapter 8 from Dear White People. Why did you choose that particular episode?
And this is definitely one that is a kind of showcase episode. It's a two-person episode. It's basically a bottle episode, and it's two main characters, Logan Browning's Sam and John Patrick Amadori's Gabe, and they're basically talking their way through the collapse of their relationship and recording each other and attempting to expose the truth of their relationship and white privilege and what went wrong in one conversation, in one room over the course of an episode. The episode was written by Jack Moore and directed by series creator Justin Simien. And it's the kind of bottle episode that makes you appreciate that genre, that makes you appreciate the sort of single location TV episodes that sometimes just come across as looking cheap, which they're also supposed to be. But this was very, very tight, very well directed, and just a great episode of television within the context of a really superb second season for Dear White People that people should check out if they haven't seen it already.
Are people watching this show?
Clearly not. I don't want to say not many, because it's Netflix. Who on earth knows? It took a little while to get renewed to the second season, and in the same way that One Day at a Time also took a little while, and the slow renewals kind of give me the concern, at least, that these shows are not being either watched hugely, or people aren't making it through the full seasons, or whatever. The problem is that it's impossible to know what the Netflix metric is. So basically, if everyone were watching it, if it were Stranger Things, we would know. But otherwise, it's hard to know on a granular level with smaller shows.
Okay. All right. Next is Dissolving Margins from My Brilliant Friend.
Another show that lots of people don't seem to be watching, but really should be. The Elena Ferrante adaptation on HBO. Just really, really beautiful television, and this is an example of an episode that simply fits within the flow of the series. It's not the stunt episode. The stunt episode would have been the episode in which the main character, Elena, went to the beach and had a coming of age, and it's sort of the Elena-centric episode, and certainly I could have mentioned it. This is just an episode that does a great job of putting the characters in context, and it's about young people in a blue-collar neighborhood of Naples in the 1950s, and this episode does a particularly good job of showing their place in the world, showing their different economic statuses and what they mean and don't mean, and it has a really beautiful ending involving fireworks that's just beautiful storytelling, and it's just a great episode of TV, and perhaps an episode that, if people were going along, would cement their appreciation for this very, very good show.
Yeah, you know, I have not seen it. And I've read great things about it, and I've heard you talk about it in the past, but I still have not watched it. I should make time to do that. So
you should. It's a very good show.
Okay. All right. Next is Janet's from The Good Place,
which I saw was not making it on as many lists because it came a little late, basically. Yeah. And that was the only thing. I mean, it's the Darcy Carden centric episode, and it's fantastic, and I could have included the Jeremy Baramy episode, which to me was the funniest episode of the year of Good Place, but I felt like a lot of people were pointing that one out, and I wanted to make sure to salute Darcy Carden and this just great episode of The Good Place, and this is another one of those stunt episodes. It is very much a hey, look at Darcy Carden. She's awesome, and she can play every character on this show, and she has a Manny Jacinto impression, and she has a Kristen Bell impression, and they're all wonderful because she is just amazingly talented. And I would like to believe that this episode will put her in Emmy conversations come summer/fall, but I somehow fear that it won't, because Emmy voters can't really look past Kristen Bell and Ted Danson on this show.
Yeah,
but they could.
And they should. And as I've said before, Dan, The Good Place, for me, my opinion, best show on network TV. I mean, you know, by a lot, I think.
For me as well, it was the only network show in my top 20, so yeah. no question.
All right. How about, let's see, Legend of Two Meow Meow from Legends of Tomorrow.
I just wanted to find some way to nod in the direction of Legends of Tomorrow, which has become one of the most ridiculous shows on television in a positive way. This is a show that I legitimately hated when it premiered as a spinoff out of both Arrow and Flash. And it's a show that started off taking itself inexplicably too seriously, and then suddenly realized some point in the second season there was no reason to do that, and just became this wonderfully absurd, silly world in which anything can happen. And this was the mid-season finale of the fourth season that I wanted to single out, and it features a killer unicorn, it features an extended puppet musical number, and it is just loopy and fun, and you could tune into it and have no clue what was happening involving the plot, and it wouldn't matter to you at all because it's so wonderfully silly. And there's a lot of very dark and very serious television out there, and I think that it is important to occasionally salute well-articulated silliness.
Yeah.
And Legends of Tomorrow does it perhaps better than anyone at this point.
Yeah. Okay. That's cool. That's cool that you included that, on the list here.
There was nowhere else I was going to get to mention it. So I
right.
wanted to make sure I tossed in right. a little recognition for the pleasure that Legends of Tomorrow does often give me.
Awesome. All right. And then the last entry we've talked ad nauseum about on the show, and that's Teddy Perkins from Atlanta, which, as you mentioned, was the best episode of television from last year, and I agree with you 100%. And in an outstanding season for Atlanta, but this was just unlike anything. And I had totally forgotten, Dan, when I read your piece, that it was commercial free. I totally forgot that it aired without commercials. I guess I totally forgot that because I was so into it.
Well, it was just such a it's an episode that casts a spell, and it does what it does in a way that no other show on television would even conceive of doing, and it was tremendous. And I watched it three times in the first 4 days after it premiered, and I just don't do that because I don't have time to, but yeah. I kept watching that episode, and I kept discovering new things, and I kept responding to things differently because it's just a great half hour or 40 minutes of television.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Well, that's an interesting, some interesting choices, Dan, for the best of 2018. Let me ask you, just in general, I know there's a ton of TV, but in general, how do you feel about the television of 2018?
I think that it had a lot of, I've seen a lot of people say that there was more very good television than ever before, but maybe there was less great television. And I don't know that I necessarily entirely agree, but I think that There was some separation between the very good and then a ton of good and then a ton of awful. I think that basically sometimes people had to look a little bit harder for some of the great things. And so my number one show, as we talked about last time I was on, was America to Me on Stars. And a lot of people didn't watch that show. And a lot of people have never even heard that show exists. And so there's just so much, and so much good stuff is getting lost And so I guess that's what I like to do most in my job. You know, I'm sure I enjoy insulting Ozark a lot, and that's fun and whatever, but I'm not really hurting Ozark. Ozark will still be nominated for Golden Globes and Emmys and stuff, but I'd be much happier telling people, okay, you need to watch Lodge 49, you need to watch America to Me, you need to watch Dear White People, you need to watch My Brilliant Friend. That's where the pleasure is in casting the light into the, not really necessarily darkness, but, you know, the slightly darker corners, because there really is a lot of great stuff, and sometimes you need to look a little bit harder.
You mentioned the Golden Globes. They're this weekend. Looking forward to the broadcast. How angry will you get?
It remains to be seen.
Yeah.
I would love for Andy Samberg and Sandra Oh to be good. Nothing would make me happier. I don't go into these shows rooting for people to fail. If they were, I love the idea of their partnership, and it would make me so happy if they were to be a great hosting duo.
Yeah.
And if they were to be good enough where everyone would be like, ooh, let's think outside the box more frequently with hosts of these shows.
You know, I have to say their promos are funny. The promos that they're running right now are very funny, and I'm really looking forward to it.
And I assume I'll be plenty angry about the actual winner,
right.
But I can deal with that. I make my peace on that long time ago. But really, I would like for those two to be good hosts, because I think they set a good precedent for people trying out wacky things. And maybe the last time anyone tried something comparable, it was Anne Hathaway and James Franco,
and that did not
necessarily encourage anyone to do anything
right.
like that in the future
right.
for logical reason. Well, I would like sort of a redemption for the oddball hosting pairing, and so I really hope that we see it on Sunday night.
Yeah, well, I'll be watching it, right after the awards, I've got my Monday morning show, and we're doing our big year-end movie show, where we're unveiling our best lists and worst lists and all that stuff. So it's going to be a busy night. The Bears are in the playoffs, like right before the Golden Globes. So it's going to be, I'm not going to sleep much on Sunday into Monday morning, I can tell you that.
As long as you have good things to be talking about, you know, who needs sleep?
Exactly. I'm with you. Before we get you out of here, Dan, I'm curious, have you seen Whiskey Cavalier yet?
I have not seen Whiskey Cavalier yet. I am in the point where it's kind of week to week and performing day-to-day triage to make sure that I'm staying afloat. So at some point I need to watch Whiskey Cavalier. I think it premieres in March, and I would like for it to be good. It has some people in it I like, so...
I find it really intriguing, and I like the cast very much, and I will follow Noel from Felicity anywhere. But it sounds like an intriguing, you know, idea, and I was just wondering have they sent out screeners to you guys yet?
I definitely do have the pilot somewhere.
Okay.
And so I will definitely watch it before press tour. I think ABC is in early February. So
yeah.
I will get to it, and I have higher hopes for that than just about anything premiering on the broadcast networks at midseason. I have much higher hopes and thoughts for a lot of cable and streaming stuff.
Right.
But that's one of the few network things that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, that's why I brought it up. All right.
I hope it doesn't let us down.
Yeah, I agree. All right, Dan, always a pleasure, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter and The Fine Print. It's F-I-E-N. Always a pleasure, Dan. We'll talk to you in a bit.
Sounds good, Nick.
All right,
bye.
Take care. There's Dan Feinberg, everybody, and he will join us in a couple of weeks to talk more TV. All right, let's take a break here on 720 WGN.